As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times. Now with goals.
Hello and welcome to the game. I'm Gabriel Marcotti with the football podcast from The Times, where Premier League fans can get every goal, every game, everywhere. Apologies to those who expected to see me at our live show in Birmingham. Unfortunately, I was not able to make it, but I'm sure you had a wonderful time and you'll have plenty more chances to see me. But anyway, more important than that, back to the present and a welcome to my guests, a rare appearance in the studio. We're delighted to have Mr. Matt Hughes. And down the line, of course, it's Matt Dickinson from beautiful downtown Barnes.
Morning.
And finally, from his conservatory in Rippendon, it's Ollie Kay.
Good morning.
Oh, I like that touch where you all say good morning. It's so much more personal. Anyway, let's get started at the Emirates, Arsenal and Liverpool. Dicko, 25 points from 10 games for Arsenal. That's generally a Premier League winning pace. And yet, when you ask people, a lot of people still don't see them as likely champions. Is that because they haven't played that many good teams except for Liverpool and Spurs, and both of those were at home?
Well, I think it's probably based on a couple of things. It's based on that, that their toughest tests are still to come. United away this weekend, and some they've played few of the title contenders, and you only have to look back at their record against those teams last year. I think they got 2 points in the 6 matches against the other top four. So, yeah, that's the big hurdle they've got to cross. I think also people are reluctant maybe to accept that, you know, that all the weaknesses that we saw at the start of the season, that we saw, you know, certainly pre-Ozil signing, have been banished by his arrival. So, you know, I think clearly they've overturned expectations already. They're doing far better than any of us had anticipated, unless someone is going to tell me now that they were a genius and saw this all along. But we would probably like to wait till certainly Christmas time before we give them a rubber stamp as a team that can win the title. I think one thing I would say is that the quality of the rest of the league, the fact that we saw Chelsea slip up at the weekend, you know, having looked like they're on a strong run, you know, almost certainly does make them genuine title contenders, just because there is no other side that's going to run away with it.
Ollie, you wrote on Saturday, I think it was, you pointed out that Arsenal have more points than anybody else in calendar year 2013, and by some margin. If that's the case, then is it really fair to say that they haven't played anybody this season, when in fact their great form dates back to last season?
Well, there's actually something slightly misleading about that as well, because if you look at it, their form has been absolutely magnificent since March, I would say, the final couple of months of last season. And prior to that, they had stumbled against some of the top teams, and unquestionably, their results have been extremely good against the lesser teams in the division. But I don't get why people are, you know, using that as a stick to beat them with. I mean, I remember a few seasons ago, Man United won the title, I think it was 2008-09. They won a title by barely beating any of the top eight and yet wiping the floor with the bottom 12. That's what can happen. And if you look at Arsenal's season so far, and people are saying, well, they haven't played any of the top teams yet. Well, you look at Man United. You know, United have lost to West Brom at home, and they, you know, Chelsea lost at Newcastle. It's not, you can't just say that the games against the top teams are the only times when anyone will drop any points. It's you know, the top teams will beat each other and take points off each other. And at the moment, it's about what everyone does in the other games, and Arsenal are doing that extremely well.
I think that mini league, though, the fascinating thing is the psychology of that, isn't it? Because I think, I mean, Arsene has admitted himself that was a failing last season, that they just didn't have. That the psychologically didn't feel they had the belief or the confidence in lots of the biggest games. He's always been insistent they've had the quality, even pre-Ozil, and I think that's part of the reason why we're fascinated by that mini league of the top clubs, just because potentially it will show that Arsenal have turned a corner in terms of their conviction.
Hughie, there's two ways to look at this. You can just look at points, and then you can. And I know it's kind of airy-fairy and whatever. You can look at how a team is playing, how well they're playing, whether they're executing, whether they look good, and assume that there's some kind of correlation between that and future results. When you look at the way Arsenal are playing, do they look good? And is there somebody else who playing better football than Arsenal in the Premier League?
Not at the moment, no. They're playing very...
Well, maybe City when they play Norwich, but...
Yeah, but over the 3 months, Arsenal have played the best football and therefore deserve to be where they are at the top of the league. What I would say is, on the few occasions they've been tested, and I mean really tested under pressure by good players, they've been found wanting. They've beaten Tottenham and Liverpool, who were both pretty poor in both games against Arsenal. Arsenal took advantage of that and deserved to win. But when they were tested by Dortmund and Chelsea, they buckled under pressure. And it's that feeling that... when they're really up against it, if they can play as well as they have to, that is why I am still slightly sceptical. It's not about Ozil. They're great going forward, they're fantastic, I think, but I would worry about the back four in particular. When the pressure's on, they tend to make mistakes, and it's not just about belief. I think concentration has been a big thing for Arsenal going back several years. The amount of sort of soft late goals they've conceded from centre backs not marking, or full backs being caught up the pitch, or Koscielny doing something daft, and until they can string together a sequence of hard fought narrow victories against good teams, I think there will be doubts.
But also, if they lose, I mean, Hughie quite rightly points out the centre halves as well. I mean, they obviously Wenger made that big decision of you know, his first choice, but that was which coincided with a pickup in form in the spring. But you wouldn't. A, you've got to see these two come under more pressure, but B, if they lost one of those two, then suddenly that looks a very weak area of the team.
All right, not much love for Arsenal thus far, or at least their title prospects. Dicko, we have a rare occurrence here in that there's no Rory Smith, there's no Alison Rudd, there's no Tony Evans, there's no Cascarino. You know where I'm going with this. This is a Liverpool fan-free zone right now, so I think we should take advantage of that. Why were Liverpool so bad? I mean, I really thought they were really, really poor. And that Rodgers, who I think has been creative and doing all the right things, just didn't have an answer.
Well, yeah, the midfield was overrun, as you say. I mean, I'm not sure. Well, I can see why he has gone to the system he has, but I don't think I'm not sold on it. I think, you know, clearly it feels he has a surfeit of centre halves. Clearly,
because he bought two of them.
Well,
he didn't before.
But clearly he wants to play Suarez and Sturridge as a two. But ultimately, I mean, he doesn't have the wing backs to play this system. Basically, I think it needs refining, and I think ultimately, you know, he may have to sacrifice the not. You know, he can still pick Suarez and Sturridge, but he's going to have to, I think, probably shift one of them to a wider position. I think he's going to have to look at tweaking the whole structure, because not sold on Flanagan or Sissoko as wing backs. I don't see that he's going to bring the best out of Coutinho, who he's got to get back in now. He's back fit. He's got to get back in the team because he's a hugely creative force. I don't think Liverpool's form has necessarily flattered them. I think they're a developing, improving side, but I'm just not sold on that system. And I thought, ultimately, he's still got the issue of playing out of the back, which he encourages so much. They still bring a lot of pressure on themselves because, you know, Kolo Touré has always got an awful panic in him, suddenly gets very, very jittery, to say the least. I saw a lovely description of Skirt at the weekend looking like a thing, as someone said, looking like a nightclub bouncer trying to tap dance when he's got the ball at his feet. He just didn't look comfortable. And Mignolet, who I think's A great shot stopper. Also, some of his distribution is poor, and they seem to bring a lot of sort of panic and pressure on themselves. So, I think Rodgers is getting an awful lot right, but I just look at that team and the structure, and I don't think he's nailed that yet.
Ollie, is Dicko being a bit unfair in the sense that, yeah, I mean, maybe Flanagan and Sissoko are one thing, but you know, you also have Glenn Johnson and Jose Enrique will be fit one day. Henderson did an all right job, I thought, when he was out wide. And I wanted to get you on that. And also this idea of playing two strikers, which very few teams, not just in England, but in Europe, have done in recent years, Juventus being one notable exception. Between that and the three at the back, I mean, is this a line that he should be pursuing?
I think he's ended up doing this probably as a reaction to the fact that he's ended up with a lot of central defenders and perhaps not got the strength elsewhere in the team. I don't think his wide options are as good as he wanted them to be. He didn't get the number 10 that he wanted to sign in the summer.
Isn't what he does?
Well, Coutinho is an excellent number 10, but I was told in the summer that Rodgers would prefer to play him in a wide position with a number 10 coming in.
And Mkhitaryan.
I was going to hope that somebody butted in and pronounced that for me, because I'm not terribly good at it. But I also think, looking at Liverpool, I think their big problem is midfield. Now you look at Gerrard and Henderson and Lucas, and it looks solid. But I think when you've got three of them there, they are doing the work of two men. I don't think Gerrard or Lucas currently have the legs to do to support the other, which means that Henderson is there for energy and mobility alone, really. If you look at Liverpool's worst performances this season, their midfield has been overrun. And it's what we said of Manchester United over the last few seasons. When they're bad, the midfield is a problem. I don't think the formation, the three centre-backs or the wing-backs was the problem on Saturday. I think the midfield was a problem, because I thought they really couldn't live with Ramsey and Arteta in particular.
Suarez is so good and works so hard. Why can't he play at 10 in sort of the way that Rooney has done for Man United so effectively, which means that when you've got the ball, you've got two strikers. When you haven't, you haven't.
But also, I think Sturridge can play fan out wide. Coutinho, as Ollie said, maybe is best not as a number 10. I mean, if you know, part of the reason why they were outplayed in midfield, they got the three centre backs, and who were they all picking up? I just didn't seem a very sensible use of resources against a team like Arsenal that are got so many rotating players in midfield, and you know who are each of those three centre halves picking up apart from Giroud. I just think there's got to be I know what Ollie's saying about the central midfield was the biggest problem, but I think the system contributed to that.
I mean, at the risk of sounding like a tactical Euro snob here, though, but isn't there kind of a learning curve there? If you play three at the back against one striker, obviously if you leave everybody in position, you know, as if they were like table football players, then, yeah, as you said, you'll have three people surrounding Giroud. But isn't that where sort of the coaching and the adjusting and the tactical work that you might do during the week and those boring tactical sessions come in, where you know, you learn to adjust with that, and one guy picks up Giroud, one guy sweeps, the other one goes and picks up the faster one, perhaps picks up the runner or what from midfield or something. I mean, we don't expect three dudes to stand in a line, right? That's not what they do, right?
I think Rodgers, it sounds like we're battering him. I think he's getting more right than wrong, but I just think that the and maybe, as you say, until he gets Glenn Johnson and Enrique back, then maybe he himself can't sort of finesse the system that he really wants. And Coutinho's only just come back from injury. And as I say, I think Coutinho is absolutely key to making a system work. But I just look at that one and I think it was wrong on two or three, you know, pretty substantial levels, really.
Moving on to Tyneside, Newcastle and Chelsea. Now, it's been a really turbulent time at Newcastle of late, with fan protests and media getting banned, and we're going to talk about that in our debate in a minute. Hughesy, when you see a game like this where really the momentum seems to be with Chelsea, especially after Newcastle losing the big derby against Sunderland and whatever, how do you explain it?
Well, at the risk of sounding stupid, it's football, isn't it? That's why we like it. You can't always explain results, otherwise no one.
So there's no big shift, there was no inspirational speech, it's just the Newcastle players actually have enough pride that they said, well, we might have screwed some things up and it might be a tough time at this club, but we're going to go out there and give our best, and even against a team like Chelsea away from home with Mourinho and all that crap, they can go and get the job done.
Obviously, there's no immediate power shift between those two clubs or in the league as a whole, but I think Alan Pardew did something interesting that might give other teams an idea of how to play against Chelsea. He afterwards said that, you know, he decided to start slowly and frustrate and spoil, and it worked. And I think that was often a tactic that's used against the best teams, and I think it could be quite effective against Mourinho's Chelsea because he's such a sort of proactive manager, and he often makes great substitutions that have an impact. But I think sometimes he can be forced into reacting too early if things aren't going his way, and I think that's what happened on Saturday. He's got so many options. He looks at his bench. He could bring on three or four different players. Well, I can't bring on four, but he can make lots of changes.
And
Newcastle frustrated them. They didn't score, and then Newcastle scored goals on the counter-attack, and Chelsea lacked the quality to respond, and Mourinho was left to sort of throw on Willian and Eto in sort of an act of desperation, really. So I think kudos to Alan Pardew for doing a job on them.
Dicko, was this a Pardew master plan? Or, I mean, if I wear my Mourinho hat, and I know he didn't say that. He said that he smelled the defeat and blah, blah, blah. But
afterwards.
You know, if afterwards, yeah. But if Terry's header goes in, then, you know, all of a sudden Chelsea can retreat into the shell, and then it could be a very long afternoon for Newcastle.
Well, exactly. Well, that's the risk when, I mean, say Pardew, I thought Pardew sort of struck the balance right. He wasn't trying to, you know, say that he had come up with any genius. I think, you know, he just said, we're going to try and keep it tight, conserve energy, knowing Chelsea are, you know, generally seen as a, you know, very strong, intense team, especially under Mourinho and with a strong bench. But as you say, that's a strategy that does look very clever in these circumstances, but can be completely undone by that, you know, supposed solid first half being unpicked by a goal, and whether it's just from a set piece. But no, I thought why Chelsea, you know, someone like Torres, who would look so superb against City, why he suddenly looked flat, why, you know, someone like Luiz, who's got so much to prove, suddenly has one of his off days, you know, why Mata, Oscar, you know, didn't fizz. Well, say, as Susie said, sometimes these days happen. I didn't think Chelsea were awful first half personally, but a bit flat.
Ollie, given the weather conditions and stuff, did Mourinho get this one wrong with some of his player personnel choices?
Well, what would he have done differently for the weather? Well,
maybe not start.
Did David Luiz not like the rain, or
no? But maybe you don't start Mata and Torres.
Well, I think if he wasn't starting Mata, he'd be starting somebody fairly similar and narrow, wouldn't he? I mean, is Mata any less equipped to play in unpleasant weather than?
I'd argue that because he's small and skillful, that, you know, driving rain and maybe not the greatest pitch in those conditions away from home, maybe you go with something else.
It's a game for putting Ramirez on the right and playing Mikel and Lampard, isn't it, probably?
Yeah, to just get a little more physical. I mean, you're up against Kabay and Sissoko, who are two guys who can play.
My other concern would be, sort of, you know, from a Chelsea point of view, is every time they lose, Mata seems to carry the can, so I'd be worried that he obviously got taken off Saturday. He could be on the bench for another 3 weeks now, which seems a little bit harsh to pin all the team's failings on their most talented player.
And it's a strange thing where any time Mata plays well, like he did in the League Cup, people, you know, because of the sort of Mourinho narrative, people say, oh, look, you know, it's working what Mourinho's done, you know, brilliant management, he's got Mata playing. You think, well, no, Mata was playing a lot better the last two seasons under, what is it, three different managers. I don't think he's handling Mata well. It certainly doesn't seem to be working very well for Mata. Chelsea are second in the table, but are they second or they're joint second. But I still have doubts about the way Chelsea are going. I don't think, if we're talking about doubts about Arsenal, I've got the same doubts about Chelsea, and I'm same doubts about Manchester City and Manchester United and everybody else. And it's
We say you have the same doubts. You have different doubts, I'm assuming, from team to team.
Maybe some similar amount of doubt.
You can ask. It's a good point Ollie makes about, as you say, about sort of Mourinho genius psychology, and as you say, look what he's doing with Mata. I mean, it's the same with Luiz. I mean, I think, you know, I don't say the manager is not entitled to have his doubts about Luiz, but I think there is an absolute top draw player in there, and it's his job as manager to coax that player out.
So, unlike your mate, you don't think that he plays as if he's controlled by a kid on a PlayStation?
I thought that was a great line,
but a bit harsh, maybe.
I think Gary said that it was a bit harsh subsequently, but I think, you know, I think there is a top draw player in there, and I'm not saying he's not without his faults. He can be over emotional. He can be he can try and sort of do too much. He can try and run a game. He can have lapses, but I think. Ultimately, if I was a coach, I'd want to start with the qualities that Luiz has and be hopeful that I could turn him into a top draw player.
Hughie, I want to ask you, I just want to mention Loic Remy, because he scored some big goals for Newcastle this season. And I was kind of struck by this, because here was a guy who was, you know, supposedly future superstar, second coming of Thierry Henry as a teenager. Then he goes to Marseille as an absolute stinker. Then he moves to QPR and has, you know, some major issues off the pitch as well, which I think, now this is where I get scared about your weirdo legal system you have here, if I can mention this, but I think it's safe to say that they are still there and could yet affect him. In any case, must be a big distraction. And now he looks to have regained his mojo. Was this actually a tremendous signing by Joe Kinnear? I was joking about that part, is this something where they nailed it? And does it really matter if he forms a strike partnership, if he can keep playing like that?
Well, he's a gamble, isn't he? Clearly got ability, but clearly got off the field behavioural problems, attitude, however you would choose to describe it.
But he's on loan, though, right? So yeah. I mean, that's the good. He's on loan. You've got a fixed price if you want to buy him. I mean, surely that's smart business from Newcastle, rather than actually throwing another $10 million at, you know, another guy who may or may not work out.
Yeah, it's smart if it works, but it could equally have not worked. So I guess Newcastle deserve credit for taking a risk. I mean, the checkered career path that you refer to is the reason he's at Newcastle. Arsenal, Tottenham were all over him at a very young age, looked at him a lot at Marseille, and for whatever reason, partly price, partly they didn't want to take the gamble, chose not to, which is why I ended up at QPR and now on loan at Newcastle.
Well, clearly a bit of a gamble given the other issues you're alert to. But I say, every time I saw QPR, there were only two things to enthuse about. One was Andros Townsend, whatever happened to him, and the other was Remy. I thought when he did play, he was such a cut above anything else on that pitch.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
you know.
Oh, my God. Dicko, I don't know if you realize what you just said. I'll try to say this back to you. You said, whenever you watch QPR over the last two seasons, there were only two things to enthuse about.
I assume he was joking.
I'm assuming you were joking when you mentioned Townsend and Remy, and you don't mention the most, well, I'd say maybe one of the five or six most talented players in the Premier League?
What's that?
Adele Tarapt?
Oh, Tarapt, yes. What happened to him?
Exactly.
You know, it was...
he's better than you.
You interrupted me in my prime of flow. But no, Remy's a... Put this way, if you can look like a quality footballer in that QPR team last season, then you must have something.
I'm upset and offended that you didn't mention Tarapt. Some of us are still a little more romantic. Now, nothing too romantic about this next topic. It's the issue of, I guess you'd call it, relationships between newspapers, especially local newspapers, and the clubs they cover. Now, people like me who live in the capital and rarely venture outside the M25, I have difficulty relating to this. So I will hand it over to you, Ollie, since you're out in the provinces. Now, Newcastle, of course, have famously banned their three local newspapers, accusing them of taking a stance against the club. But also another paper, I believe a paper you once worked at, or at least might have read, the Stoke Sentinel, have been banned from covering Port Vale. There's a story in the BBC, apparently like Port Vale are asking them for money or something. It's a bizarre story. So given that you have more Stoke experience than any of us, start with you, Ollie.
The Port Vale one is extremely strange, where the chairman has actually demanded that the club, or the paper, pay £10,000 to gain access to the club, as in press box access, interview access, you know, even the slightest entry into the corridors of power. I find that just remarkable. I know Port Vale are extremely hard up and so on, but they are, so are local newspapers, so are all newspapers. And the idea that, I know television pay for TV rights, the Times now pay for Premier League rights, but the idea that local papers should be paying huge amounts for access to the local team, which they advertise pretty much on a daily basis, is just extraordinary and insulting, and I find it an offensive idea, whether it's at Newcastle, or whether it's Nottingham Forest sort of treating the Nottingham Evening Post, another ex-paper of mine, as...
For those of us who don't follow you or Daniel Taylor on Twitter, can you tell us what this business in Nottingham is?
We'd be better getting Danny Taylor on than do that. And I'm not sure his contract would permit that. The Nottingham Evening Post business, I believe it's due to, it's basically the new regime there, the Kuwaiti regime there, and the various people that they brought in, just seeing the entire media as some kind of hostile force. I mean, we all know about the famous Fleet Street and indeed famous local Nottingham anti-forest agenda, don't we? It's well established. It's just the classic kind of football fan paranoia about anti-media agenda creeping into clubs, and anti-club agenda creeping into clubs, and there are childish people running clubs who are just sort of hitting out at the media and saying, well, we don't like your message, so we're going to shut you up.
Dicko, so where did this all go wrong? I mean, you have more years' experience than the rest of us. And
I'm older than the rest of you.
Well, no, I think you're more experienced.
I've got the hair to show for it. I wrote about this with Alex Ferguson and one regret, and obviously that sort of flared up again a bit with his book and various stories around that. But one great regret I have from time covering the Manchester beat is the way that, you know, he would scream and shout over something that was a story that was more often than not true, perfectly valid, and throw someone out and ban, and we would either snigger and go and sort of tell our mates and write up stories and not basically suddenly just not stand there and have some solidarity and say, actually, this is wrong, and what, you know, one out, all out. And I say I've written that that is a regret, that actually, as an industry, we should have gathered together and said, no. That's an outrageous way to treat one of our colleagues. We're not putting up with it now. It's quite possible he'd have said, "Okay, go to hell with a lot of you," and there would have been no press conferences. And I suspect maybe that was one of the reasons why we didn't, was because, you know, the nature of the profession is pretty cutthroat and competitive, and you know, each art the Times want the best stories they can get and aren't going to shed too many tears over the Telegraph or the Daily Mail. But yeah, that is a regret, and I think that probably still doesn't happen enough, that the industry as a whole sticks up for itself, and that, you know, if one paper is thrown out, that the rest gather around and just say, no, this is outrageous treatment, this is wrong, and somehow collectively gang up back against a club or an owner or whoever's acting so ridiculously.
Yeah, Dicko, this is one thing which I find strange, in the sense that, I mean, in other countries, in Germany, in Italy, when stuff like this has arisen, that's exactly what's happened. You've had walkouts, you've had newspapers printing blank pages, you've had papers, and clubs absolutely hate this. They'd print photographs, but then they would black out the names of the sponsors. We're sort of straying a bit from football here, but I could see the argument when people bought their paper on the way to work, back when everybody took public transport, and you would buy it based on the back page, and you might buy three or four or five papers. You know, this level of competition and the importance of being there at press conferences. But now that information is so tightly controlled anyway, coming out of the clubs, and a lot of the stuff is streamed on the web and whatever else, is it really that important? Are there more effective ways to fight back? And might it actually make it simpler for the media to act in concert here, Dicko?
Well, I think that from the news, without sounding too defensive on behalf of newspapers, but I think one reason is that clearly the newspapers haven't sort of withdrawn more cooperation, is that newspapers feel like they're being, you know, pushed further from the action. I mean, the advent of Sky, advent of 24-hour, you know, sports news channels. Clearly, newspapers, you know, feel like we give a different service. We give, you know, are able to hopefully still speak to people behind the scenes, hopefully give a more in-depth coverage, hopefully, you know, chase up a lot of stories that the broadcast world, you know, doesn't bother with or have the time
for. But sorry, Dicko, but being banned from a press conference, I mean, that doesn't stop you doing any of those things.
No. But what I'm saying is that, you know, there is a degree of paranoia that we don't want to, you know, step back any more than we're already being forced to. And I think there is a balance to be struck here. And I think if a club starts acting outrageously, I think there should be more strong, decisive, up yours, robust, you know, response from newspapers. I think newspapers should be more front foot, say, and say a regret is, particularly with you know, specific managers, if they start bullying people, then they should be told more firmly than ever happened with Ferguson that's completely out of order. But I'd say also it has to be balanced with the worry that clubs will increasingly try and sort of push us away and increasingly try and use their own TV stations and just give out official press conferences, official, you know, any time a player is signed at Chelsea, you know, they do this sort of, you know, blah, blah, bland interview on Chelsea TV. And you would hope that the world isn't going to be reduced to a point where everything is controlled by official channels.
Ollie, I want to get you on this just because I think, you know, obviously you have extensive experience at local news, but I guess you guys all do. What I find really interesting about the situation in Newcastle and the situation, obviously, that you described in Stoke and Nottingham, is that I would have thought that there's like a very natural synergy between local football club and local newspaper. And I'm trying to imagine why. At the times I've been outside the M25 and bought a local newspaper, it was basically for the sport to see how they covered the local team. You get a level of coverage that, especially outside the top flight, that you know, you're simply not going to find in the national news media, because inevitably we are obsessed with Manchester United and Arsenal and Liverpool and whatnot. I'm just trying to imagine, like, why is that falling apart? Are there local websites which come into it, or is this just a case, in the case of Newcastle, a bit of a paranoid club with a bit of an unusual owner?
Well, you look at the clubs where that has fallen apart. It's Newcastle, it's Blackburn, it's Nottingham Forest. It's clubs where owners have come in and they've been very overpowering. They've done a lot of things the wrong way. I think if you look at Forest, I'd say they're perhaps the jury's still out on the owners there, because I think they are they're making progress on the pitch, but they are blundering and upsetting a lot of people, not just journalists, but you know, ex-players and people who have been part of the fabric of the club for a long time. So I mean people say, well, the newspapers have changed. I think local newspapers, in the way that they try to cover their football clubs, have probably changed so little over the last 20-30 years. Local papers want things to be the way they've always been, which is where, you know, they are the fans' first port of call for, you know, injury news, transfer news, whatever on their team, particularly in the sort of towns I mentioned, like Nottingham and Blackburn and so on. And that sort of bond is being damaged, not by the papers, but by the atmosphere that's being created by fairly erratic, volatile owners. I mean, there's something similar, I suppose, at Cardiff with fairly volatile owners there. I haven't heard about press bans yet, but it's probably a matter of time if they keep reporting dissatisfaction among the fans. And these people, these owners, don't seem to understand that there is dissatisfaction, and that it's the paper's job, the media's job to report it. It's not the club's website's job to report dissatisfaction among the fans, because they have a role that seems to be a little like Pravda. But you know, if the fan base is upset, then how can a media organisation, a local paper, ignore that? It's protest marches, etc. It's just I don't quite understand what they think local papers should be doing.
I think one thing that has changed is that fans have become a lot more educated in the way football works, and also more militant through blogging and Twitter and whatever, and then that gives the local papers a problem. How much do they empathise with the issues, the feelings of their fans, their readerships, which obviously clash with often clash with the agenda of the club? And I think that's where the Newcastle papers have got into problem by, from the club's point of view, they've strayed too far towards sharing the fans' concerns.
All right, time now for some quick hits. Manchester United roll out to a 3-0 first half lead over Fulham, make three subs, then hang on for a win. Ollie Moyes says it was all down to injuries. Fair enough. But it's a decent chance it could have blown up in his face, right?
Well, yeah, I suppose when you're making three half-time substitutions, I think he probably would have weighed that up, and I don't think he would have done it unless he felt it was...
It's kind of weird, though. How often does that happen, that like three guys walk off the pitch at halftime and says, like, hey, boss, we're all hurt?
Well, Cleverley was Cleverley ill or something, or he got double vision or something, so it's slightly freakish, but it wasn't the most freakish thing that happened on Saturday, and it wasn't the most consequential thing that happened on Saturday, because United hung on and finished a fairly professional performance, and probably one of the more satisfying afternoons of Moyes' tenure today.
Alan Sugar called Andre Villas-Boas tactically clueless after Tottenham's scoreless draw at Everton. Hughesy, I got a bunch of questions for you, so you can answer them quickfire. Do you concur with Sugar's assessment? Is it wise to stick with Soldado ahead of Defoe? And finally, what'd you make of the Lloris coming back on after getting whacked in the head? It seemed kind of weird.
Well, he's clearly not tactically clueless. He may sort of speak a version of English that many of us mere mortals don't understand, but he knows what he's doing. He led Porto to that great unbeaten season. And I think, given he's started from scratch almost this year at Tottenham, he's done a decent job. They're fourth in the league. They've got a point at Goodison, which over the course of the season will be seen to be a pretty good result. They just need to score a few more goals and work a way of providing better service to Soldado. he's a strange player, Soldado. He's actually, in some ways, he's like Defoe. You only notice him when he's scoring goals, and when he's not, he's a bit of a peripheral presence, which increases the importance of Tottenham working out their sort of number 10 position. And as for Hugo Lloris, yes, it was strange, but again, I have a bit of sympathy for AVB. The decision should really be taken out of his hands in terms of head injuries. At the time, in the heat of the moment, the keeper says he's fine. Probably a mistake, but he let him play on. I played a lot of rugby as a kid, and it was the old count my fingers, you're fine, get back on with it. Obviously, these days, health and safety regs are a bit tighter and global exposure. AVB looks a bit silly this morning, but at the time, I could understand the decision.
You just explained a lot there, Hughesy.
I should also point
out... I've only got four fingers.
I should point out, too, Hughesy, that you're from Yorkshire and therefore hard, whereas Hugo Lloris is from the south of France and therefore preternaturally soft. Now, it looks like a Martin O'Neill, Roy Keane dream team at the helm of the Republic of Ireland. Dicko, is Martin O'Neill asking for trouble? And could you define success for the Republic?
Well, I'm still trying to get the bottom of how much this is O'Neill's idea and how much Roy Keane has been sort of shoved his way by the FA over there. I have to say, I mean, I think they get on pretty well as individuals, but Roy Keane as anyone's number two, I'm slightly worried and troubled by it. I think Tony Cascarino mentioned this morning that is Roy Keane really the sort of classic guy you go to as your number two to put his arm around a player who's had a hard time or to G up the troops. I'm really not convinced by that role. So, yes, there's a lot of questions still to be answered about that, how he's got that job. As for what would constitute success, well, clearly under Michel Platini's new expanded Euros, success is to qualify, simple as that. I think Ireland were fourth in the World Cup group. They've got to improve on that.
Cardiff beat Swansea in the Welsh Derby, and as I watched on television, I heard somebody say that there are very few games in the world bigger than this. So, Ollie, was it all that it was cracked up to be? And would you say Vincent Tan contributed a lot, very much, or immensely to Cardiff's victory?
Immensely, as ever. It was, I'm just trying to think, it would have been 17 hours from the time I left home at 8:45 in the morning, from the time I got back from Cardiff. And it was, you know, I think by that time, I think probably the excitement had just about worn off. But it was, I went there with huge expectations of it as a match and as an occasion. And I think it probably didn't live up to those, it's fair to say. The atmosphere was good and lively and peaceful. But it was, it felt a little less special to us outsiders than perhaps I felt it would. But it was a great result, great story for Cardiff, and hopefully some breathing space for Malcolm Mackay.
In keeping with our Welsh theme, Chris Coleman, who once told me that he basically grew up where Twin Town was filmed and he used to march around in those little uniforms when he was a little boy, now he's reportedly in pole position to take over at Crystal Palace following Ian Holloway's dismissal. Hughesy, is this a wise choice, and will it make a difference to Palace staying up?
Well, it actually looks like an appointment that's predicated on them planning for relegation, to be honest, which is probably sensible, but I'm still not sure he's the right man for the job, and I'm not convinced he's better qualified than Ian Holloway to take Palace down and then try to get them back up again. He's a lovely bloke, Chris Coleman, very quotable, very approachable.
He's also taller and more handsome than Ollie.
He certainly is, but I'm not sure they're prerequisites for managing in the Premier League. But if you look at his career, he started very well at Fulham and seemed to do well as an old-school manager, managing through the force of his personality and his enthusiasm. Since then, he's sort of, everywhere he's gone, he's not really had any success, not done great with Wales, so I can't really see what he's done to justify such an appointment, other than the fact that he's a former player and maybe well-received in the short term.
Manchester City put 7 past Norwich, and it could have been 17, maybe even 170. Dicko, why can't Pellegrini get City to play like this every week? Is it because they don't play Norwich, or at least this version of Norwich, every week?
Well, that is the first point. You would be lucky to find a team as abject and defendingly as abject, particularly as Norwich at the weekend. I think they seem to. I mean, confidence. You know, does you know confidence and habits build up over time? Home form good. The way they seem to be get jittery. I think. I mean, they only played one striker away at Chelsea last week, and they played two at home. So he's got. He's been tweaking his approach. Maybe I think they've got Sunderland to come. Maybe if he sort of tries to be a bit bolder there, he can sort of they can you know break this hoodoo they've got away from home where they've thrown away some silly ease. I mean, clearly they need to defend better away from home. Teams may sense that they're a bit more vulnerable. He's been chopping and changing the centre halves. Company being injured, they've not been say the centre halves have not been settled. Maybe, by being a bit bolder away from home, they can sort of relieve the pressure on that defence.
Gab, one for you. You wrote about Mohamed Aboutrika in the Times today. Tell me why I, and indeed all our listeners, should read it.
Well, apart from the fact that it's extremely well written. No, I just think he's a great tale. Arguably the best player in the world, never to have played in Europe or South America. Played for Egypt, so unusual in so many ways. He has a degree in philosophy. He's won three African Cup of Nations. Played a huge role as well, just politically in some of the changes that have happened in Egypt of late. And it just got me thinking about the fact that he never moved to Europe to the big times, and make the point that Mido is probably the most famous Egyptian footballer, and I just found that really, really depressing that people know who Mido is simply because he hung around so many European clubs and so many leagues for so long. Not that
and,
he's a bad
and
guy.
And nightclubs.
And nightclubs as well. And very few people know who Aboutrika is. Thanks to my panel, Matt Hughes, Matt Dickinson, and of course, Ollie Kay. If you love football, and I'm guessing you do, please check out details of our upcoming live show via the links on our SoundCloud page. Thank you for listening. Remember, you can get in touch with us, as so many of you do every single week, gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk, or also on Twitter. Dicko's on there, Ollie's on there, Hughesy's on there, perhaps a little less frequently than the other two, but they all love hearing from you, and I guarantee they will all write back to you personally if you only just tweet them. Till next time, bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.